listen to music and podcasts from CGSF 90.1 FM with our radio app. It's on-the-go listening made easy. You can tune into all our music, spoken word, and multicultural shows using your device. Our app lets you set reminders so you'll never miss your favorite show again. Stay connected to CGSF 90.1 FM through our community radio app. Download the app from the Apple Store or get it on Google Play.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, a conversation with Dutch-Palestinian commentator Mouin Rabbani about Israeli genocide in Gaza.
Without these constant deliveries of tons and tons and tons and tons of U.S. weapons to Israel, without the vetoes at the United Nations Security Council, without the U.S. aircraft carriers, Israel would be unable to fight for even a single additional day. So it would take no more than a phone call to say it's over.
About the division between the Palestinian people and its aging autocratic leader, a situation much to America's liking.
Do the Americans really want to see a meaningful and effective Palestinian national movement and leadership? All the available evidence suggests that they are much more comfortable with Palestinian weakness and a Palestinian leadership that is isolated from its people and acts against their interests rather than on their behalf.
And about what the future holds for the Palestinian people and Israel.
I think that we're now headed for a period of exceptional instability and insecurity. If I was an Israeli leader, I would be quite concerned.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Before diving in, a request. Help us deliver this weekly package of Earth News. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. October 7th, 2023, 5 weeks shy of the first anniversary of that morning's astonishing events and the launch of Israel's genocidal response, the GPM sat down with one of the conflict's most astute observers. Mouin Rabbani is a Dutch-Palestinian researcher, analyst, and commentator specializing in Palestinian affairs, the Arab-Israeli conflict, and contemporary Middle East issues. Rabbani has served as the head of political affairs with the Office of the United Nations Special Envoy for Syria and as senior Middle East analyst and special advisor on Israel-Palestine with the International Crisis Group. These days, Mouin Rabbani is a non-resident fellow at the Middle East Council on Global Affairs and co-editor of Jadalia.com. I sat down with Mouin Rabbani in The Hague. What would the United States do if the United States were to suddenly decide, okay, the game is over. We're not going to attempt to pressure Israel anymore. We're not going to attempt to use our leverage anymore with Israel. We're going to go right over Israel's head and end the war. Like, suppose Kamala Harris wins. Mm-hmm. And the Democrats win both houses of Congress, which would be kind of amazing. Mm-hmm. With all that power,
yeah.
What could Kamala Harris do, and how could Joe Biden get the ball rolling in his last 4 months? What would they actually do concretely?
Well, I think, you know, for those who retained any doubts, I think one thing that we've learned in the last year is how extraordinarily dependent Israel has been and remains on the United States. I mean, you know, the Israelis and their American supporters have created this entire myth of, you know, an Israel capable of defending itself by itself and all the rest of it. But what we've learned is that without these constant deliveries of tons and tons and tons and tons of U.S. weapons to Israel, far exceeding even the air bridge that was established in October 1973. You know, without the weapons deliveries, without the vetoes at the United Nations Security Council.
Without the oil for the jet fighters.
Without the oil for the jet fighters, which is, in fact, the main supplier is Azerbaijan through Turkey, rather than the U.S. Directly. But, you know, without the U.S. aircraft carriers in the Eastern Mediterranean, without the U.S.-UK Naval Task Force in the Red Sea, Israel would be unable to fight for even a single additional day. So, as I've been arguing all along, it would take no more than a phone call to say it's over. And you mentioned Biden in this respect. Well, in 2021, there were also quite intense hostilities between Israel and the Palestinians in the West Bank, and then ultimately also in the Gaza Strip. And at a certain point, the Biden administration, you know, it's actually interesting. You had the U.S. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Mark Milley was his name at the time, and he was giving congressional testimony and was quite clear, you know, that at a time of growing demonstrations in solidarity with the Palestinians throughout the Middle East, Milley, in his congressional testimony, said, in so many words, we need this conflict to stop before it begins threatening the U.S. position and U.S. interests in the wider region. I think it was a day or two later that Biden called Netanyahu, and according to numerous press reports, the phrase he used was, "You've run out of road." And it immediately stopped, because Netanyahu clearly understood that without U.S. support, Israel would be unable to fight for even a single day. And it really is that simple.
But Gaza is now in ruins.
Yes.
It's been completely reduced, virtually completely reduced to rubble.
Yes.
It's hard to imagine how Gaza is going to be reconstructed and how the population of Gaza is going to be able to continue living there.
Yes.
Amidst the ruins
question.
With Israeli troops inside Gaza or along the borders ready to pounce upon them once again.
Well,
The occupation has to end. It isn't simply a matter of cutting off arms supplies and fuel provisions to the Israelis. The occupation has to end, and it'll only end if the United States makes it end. So do you see this? How do you see this happening?
Yes, well you're...
And cutting to the chase, I think the only way this can happen is through a UN Security Council resolution under Chapter 7.
Well, no.
Which would be enforceable.
Yes, but I think there are several separate issues that we're discussing here. The first is, does the U.S. have the capacity to impose its will on Israel? So quite apart from, you know, what would happen afterwards, the point I'm making is that it's indisputable that in the U.S.-Israeli relationship, you know, despite all the factors that you mentioned earlier, it is Israel that is a U.S. proxy and not the other way around. And if Washington takes a decision, that decision will be automatically translated into Israeli policy. I do believe that it is that simple. The second issue you raised was what would happen to the Gaza Strip in the wake of what's happened during the past 10 months. And I think it's a crucial point, because I also believe that one of Israel's war objectives, and if not an explicit objective, at least an explicit outcome of its genocidal onslaught, has been an effort to make the Gaza Strip unfit for human habitation. Civilian infrastructure has been systematically razed to the ground. We're talking about the educational system, health infrastructure, water infrastructure, and all the rest of it. And it's going to be, you know, this is probably the most intensive bombing campaign since the Second World War. This is hardly the first time that Israel has launched a fierce onslaught on the Gaza Strip. It's far and away the most intensive. But you know, it doesn't make much sense to rebuild something that's going to be demolished again in a few years. And what is urgently needed is a comprehensive political resolution that ends the occupation, that sees a Palestinian right to self-determination realized.
But how does that happen exactly? And it wouldn't happen unless the United States agrees. The sine qua non for this comprehensive political solution is for the United States to say, now there is going to be a comprehensive, definitive solution. Yes.
And here, unfortunately, I don't think there are quick fixes. I think you're seeing growing popular pressure on governments in the West, including in the United States, for a change in policy. And in the region, you've had, let's say, one consistent policy that the U.S. has had, is that it has opposed the further regional expansion of this conflict. I mean, it's true that the policies it has pursued have virtually guaranteed the further regional expansion, but here again, we come to a cost-benefit analysis. In the current reality, the United States sees no real costs to maintaining its policy of unconditional support of Israel. If that were to change, that would make a change in U.S. policy more likely. Now, in terms of, you mentioned the United Nations Security Council in Chapter 7, well, that was the model that was applied in 1990-91 to force Iraq out of Kuwait. I see this as a much less likely scenario. I can't imagine the U.N. Security Council passing Chapter 7 resolution, forcing Israel out of the occupied territories, and then, you know, sending in the B-2s and the F-35s if Israel refuses to withdraw.
Well, I have this vision of, you know, an international naval force gathering off the coast of Gaza, staging an amphibious landing, I mean in cooperation indirectly with Hamas, because Hamas says we don't want any international intervention. But I'm not sure they've got any choice. Move into Gaza and push the Israelis out and start reconstructing, providing humanitarian aid, while at the same time, you know, crossing over the King Hussein Bridge, over the Jordan River from Jordan, an international intervention force, telling Israel to stand down, get out of the Jordan Valley. Your occupation is ending.
They could do it. Of course they could do it.
I don't want to say it would be incredibly simple, mm-hmm. but it could be easily done.
Well, I could foresee circumstances in which there is a break between the United States and Israel on specific issues, and ultimately the occupation may be one of them. I don't think I'm intellectually or philosophically equipped to conceive of a situation in which the U.S. would use armed force or even the threat of armed force to compel Israel to achieve this objective.
But they're dear, dear friends. All that has to happen is for the United U.S. president and, you know, senior military officials to tell Israel, we love you, you're getting out.
We're cutting off all supplies.
You're getting out, and we'll give you 24 hours to agree unconditionally. And if you don't, we're going to start moving in, and you're going to stand down. Well, and there's not going to be a conflict. The Israelis are not going to be firing on the Americans, and vice versa.
No, but again, given the nature of the U.S.-Israeli relationship, it also raises a question of, would the U.S. even have to make such threats? Because I think what many people would argue is, in fact, what the U.S. would need to do under, and again, we're speaking purely theoretically here, is basically to tell the Israelis, this is what's going to happen, and if you reject our proposal, there will be no more arms deliveries, there will be no more vetoes at the U.N. Security Council, there will be no more us lobbying, you know, the ICJ and the ICC incessantly on your behalf. We will no longer use our big stick to beat our allies and adversaries over the head to basically, you know, either stop supplying weapon systems to your adversaries or not to vote against you and all. So basically, withdrawing the cloak of impunity that the U.S. has extended to Israel and threatening to replace it with the reality of accountability. I think that would have a transformative impact.
Muin Rabbani is a Dutch-Palestinian researcher, analyst, and commentator specializing in Palestinian affairs, the Arab-Israeli conflict, and contemporary Middle East issues. He's a non-resident fellow at the Middle East Council on Global Affairs and co-editor of Jadalia.com. We'll link to Jadalia at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, subscribe. With your help, we'll keep delivering stories about planet Earth, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. The Vietnamese had Uncle Ho. Black South Africans had Mandela, supported by the ablest of comrades, black and white, from Southern Africa to the Maghreb, from the Indian Ocean to the Atlantic. National liberation movements and their leaders shook off European colonial rule. In historic Palestine, Europe's sole surviving settler colonial state, arguably the most robust, national liberation has proven far more elusive. I asked Muin Rabbani about this. Is there a Palestinian national liberation movement?
Yes and no. I would say there are Palestinian liberation movements, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, Fatah, PFLP, and others. But what we don't have is a single unifying Palestinian political structure fulfilling the functions, for example, that the PLO fulfilled over many years in the 70s and 80s, or that the ANC fulfilled in South Africa. And on this point, I would say that no party is innocent for this state of affairs. Certainly, Hamas has its share of responsibility, and certainly Fatah as well, but it has also been my view that the ultimate responsibility for this state of affairs lies with Mahmoud Abbas. And from what I've seen, is that there have been repeated initiatives during the past years that have in fact resulted in agreements between Hamas and Fatah. And these have ultimately been sabotaged by Mahmoud Abbas, not by the Fatah movement, but by him.
And there's just been this gathering in China, in Beijing.
Yes.
11 factions, Palestinian groups and parties and factions gathering together and announcing that there had been a unification agreement.
Yes.
And, you know, Mustafa Barghouti talking about this going nowhere.
Yes, it will go nowhere.
A dead letter.
My view is that as long as Abbas remains in power until he leaves or is removed, there will be no unifying Palestinian political structure along the lines that you've suggested. He's not the only obstacle, but his removal is the prerequisite to any solution, because we've seen repeatedly over the years where he has authorized representatives of the Fatah movement to reach agreements and then undermine those agreements. He's principally opposed to implementing any of these agreements, and he's also been conducive or responsive to external pressures not to implement these agreements.
What do you think is going to happen when Mahmoud Abbas dies? Will he be effortlessly replaced by some new anointed leader like Hussein al-Sheikh, anointed by the United States and Israel, by Israel USA, will impose a new leader? There will be some struggle. The United States and Israel will ensure that their man takes charge. I would imagine that happening. What would be the response of, what do you see happening within Palestinian civil society and amongst those who are political leaders, you know, mid-level political leaders and political figures?
Well, if you would have asked me this question on October 6, what I had been saying for quite a few years before then was that until roughly the Second Intifada, Israel was invested in bilateralism And what that means is that it wanted a Palestinian partner to sign on the dotted line. And therefore, you needed a meaningful Palestinian counterpart who could, you know, carry the Palestinian side of the equation and sign on a treaty or agreement with the Israelis. What has happened in the years since 2000 is that Israel has once again reverted to unilateralism. In other words, Israel's perspective is that it has no need for a Palestinian partner because it can basically achieve its objectives in the occupied territories unilaterally. And if that's the case, then a strong Palestinian leadership becomes not a necessity, but an obstacle. And on the basis of that analysis, it had for many years been my view that when Abbas is no longer there, that Israel won't have an interest in replacing him with a centralized Palestinian leader, irrespective of how amenable that person may be to Israeli interests, and that the more likely scenario was that Israel would seek to use the succession to further fragment the Palestinians. And so until October 6, my view was that Israel, for Israel ideally, Hamas would remain in power in the Gaza Strip, because that would ensure that it remains split from the West Bank, and that within the West Bank, it would seek to promote, let's call them local warlords, you know, one in the northern West Bank of the Nablus Jenin area, one in the Ramallah Bethlehem Jericho area, and one in the south centered around Hebron. The purpose being Palestinian weakness and fragmentation, because again, a representative partner would be in a scenario of unilateralism as an obstacle rather than necessity. I think what's happened now is, from Israel's perspective, you know, maintaining a Hamas regime, if you will, in the Gaza Strip is no longer an option. And as for the West Bank, the agenda now is no longer indefinite occupation, but increasingly moving to formal annexation. As far as the U.S. and the Europeans are concerned, yes, I think they would like to have someone like Hussein al-Sheikh as kind of the Palestinian address, particularly because they would also like to see the Palestinian Authority resume its rule in the Gaza Strip.
So would they be able to impose that? Well, or would the Palestinian civil society and political leadership, such as it is, unify and insist on creating a new leader? I mean, I know a couple of years ago there was this national rescue initiative organized by, you know, two or three dozen Palestinian figures.
This was a group led by Nasser al-Qidwa.
Yeah.
Yes.
And but it came to nothing.
Yes.
So I kind of wondering, I mean, are these folks meeting in living rooms and in parlors drinking tea and talking amongst themselves, coming up with a plan? Because it's pretty difficult. They get busted up by the PA security forces if they do. I mean, what happens when Abbas dies? Will a new leader, Hussein al-Sheikh, simply be anointed by the United States? Or will these figures kind of stand up and say, no, we are going to reconstitute the Palestinian polity?
Well, I think you're likely to see several things happening at the same time. On the one hand, I would anticipate that the U.S. and the EU would try to anoint either Hussein al-Sheikh or someone with a similar profile as the formal leader of the Palestinians. But the mere fact of that happening will also be the kiss of death politically to that person. In other words, whoever is anointed by the Americans and the Europeans to replace Mahmoud Abbas will be politically irrelevant from day one. The second issue is that I do think that the Palestinian political arena, by and large, does remain a two-party system. You have Hamas and you have Fatah. It's true that Fatah is in an advanced state of disintegration, but my view, my belief, is that there is still no room in the Palestinian political arena for a third force to displace these two main movements.
And I kind of imagine Hamas getting back to that question of, you know, was it a success? October 7th, has Hamas actually achieved something positive, if you can call it positive? It's hard to do so. But whether or not now, you know, is there a Palestinian national liberation movement? If there is one, it seems to me it's Hamas.
Well, I would argue.
And Hamas is the leadership of the future.
Well, I would argue that even if you're going to take the position that the last year has been a success, you would also need to take the position that the last year has demonstrated the extraordinary cost to the Palestinians of not having a unified Palestinian leadership. And that the absolute priority now for Palestinians should be to once again develop and formalize a unified Palestinian movement. And I think if there's one thing we've learned in recent years is the idea that you cannot have hegemony in the Palestinian political arena for one party alone, whether it's Fatah and the PA or Hamas. It doesn't work. You could have the hegemony of the PLO in decades past, but that was because the PLO was not a party. The PLO was an umbrella organization under which these various movements with quite different ideologies and outlooks managed to, for better or worse, coexist and put forward a collective leadership. At least that's the way it was supposed to work. And my argument would be that, you know, you cannot have Hamas hegemony and expect an effective Palestinian national movement, just as you cannot have Fatah hegemony. And there needs to be a formula for consensus, for power sharing.
It would seem to me a really, really smart move on the part of, a Harris administration to demand, tell Israel, you're going to liberate Marwan Barghouti and you're going to let him proceed to lead the Palestinian people if this is what the Palestinian people want.
But would the Americans want a strong and effective Palestinian leadership? I mean, Marwan Barghouti is known as someone who is open to some kind of power-sharing arrangement with Hamas. Do the Americans really want to see a meaningful and effective Palestinian national movement in leadership? All the available evidence suggests that they are much more comfortable with Palestinian weakness and a Palestinian leadership that is isolated from its people and acts against their interests rather than on their behalf.
We've not talked about the axis of resistance.
Yes.
And I have certain friends, one in particular, who really sees the axis of resistance as the future in terms of, totally transforming the Middle East and bringing Israel to a sorry end, like terminating the imperial settler colonial enterprise. I myself kind of see the axis of resistance as a bit of a paper tiger. I mean, I think it's a lot of sound and light and lots of furious talk, but I find it hard to imagine Hezbollah, for example, launching really a full-scale assault on Israel, like, firing missiles at Ben-Gurion Airport and Unit 8200 and the Mossad headquarters and the rest of it. Do you think that Hezbollah is preparing to actually attack Israel? Would it do such a thing, other than peppering it, like keeping the fire going at a low?
Well, I think the axis of resistance is significantly more than a paper tiger. But I would also argue that we need to understand the axis of resistance as a coalition rather than as a formal alliance. And getting back to October 7th, if you look at Hamas's position in the axis of resistance, I mean, it's had one foot in and one foot out. You know, it was based in Damascus, which was a key member of the axis of resistance. And then in 2011, 2012, the relations with Damascus were ruptured, and it relocated to Doha, and its key allies became Qatar and Turkey, which are not by any means members of the axis of resistance. And on October 7th, all indications, including the conclusions of U.S. and Israeli intelligence are that Hamas did not coordinate its actions with its coalition partners, whether in Hezbollah or Iran and so on. And what we've seen since then is that each member of the axis of resistance on the whole has acted, including Hamas, has acted based on its, let's say, own interests and priorities.